Welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham. Once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, huge guest, two of my buddies from the band Always, Molly and Alec, are here today. And these are my buds. These are my pals. This is a fun one. We've hit the road together. We've done those highways. Well, actually, we only went on one tour. That was a long time ago. They got way more famous since then. But more on that in 1 second. But first, if you'd like to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do. And he will get the message to me. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram, or I guess X and Instagram, at LeftForDamian. Probably should start a Threads account now, huh? There's also a YouTube page, a Facebook page, a TikTok page, and an Instagram page, all for Turned Out of Punk, and all can be found at Turned Out of Punk on those platforms. I play in a band, the one I mentioned off the top that I'm on tour with Always, called Fucked Up. We will be going on tour in Europe, if you're listening to this when it drops, and you can find out more information about that over at fuckedup.cc. We have a brand new 7-inch out, Show Friends. It's not about Always. Definitely not about Always. It's a mean song. That's what I'm saying. It's not about Always. And there's more information about that over there on that website as well. So head on over there and figure it out. And hopefully I'll see you in Europe at some of those shows. Playing with Off, playing with Dino Jr., Bob Mould, Collapse, bunch of cool bands. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, my buddies, my pals from the band Always, Alec and Molly, are here. They are people that I've known for, as I said, a very long time, because we went on tour years ago, like their first record. They were already amazing by that point, but they have gone and become one of the best bands in Canada. You know, they were probably one of the best bands in Canada back then too, but like they've got even better, a better band in Canada, a bigger band, an international band now. They're very popular all over the world, as illustrated by the fact that if you're listening to this podcast, when it does come out, you can go over there to Always, I think it's just Always with two V's, allvays.com, and find out all their tour dates. But they're going to be in like Mexico City, then they're going to like Taiwan, Singapore, Indonesia, Japan, Australia, probably New Zealand. Yep, New Zealand, Hawaii. So head over there and find out all those tour dates and check out their latest record. It is Blue Rev, which is out on the great Polyvinyl Records. And you can find out more information once again at that allvays, always with two V's instead of a W.com. And yeah, as I said, we went on tour. We were huge fans of them in Fucked Up back then. And seeing them on that tour, you knew they were destined for great things and far bigger things than playing shows for us, with us. And that has been borne out. I got to get on stage with them. They did a Queen of Hearts cover for an encore one time. And I went out there and as I met the dead eyes of the audience, having no idea or no interest in who I was, I realized, you keep going, kids. You've eclipsed me at this point. And it's been awesome to watch, as I say. They keep putting out great records, though. We were listening to them and the Dolly Mixtures back-to-back the other day, and it was, like, very cool to see a band that has that kind of influence go to a sense that they have. I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Check out that new record. Check them out on tour. And then sit back, relax. Or sit back and relax and then do all that other stuff. And enjoy Molly and Alec on Turned Out a Punk. Alec, Molly, thank you for coming on the show.
Hi, Damian.
Yo.
This has been a long time to happen. Like, we talked about doing this years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the last time I saw you was at the Danforth.
It was. And I was thinking, well, you know, minus the pandemic, that's not that long ago. But then I went to pick up my youngest child, who's now like a 7-year-old adult. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that was a very long time ago because I had him on stage as a baby.
I think I was on your shoulders, too, at one point.
Yes. Yeah, you got on my shoulders. We had that was wild. Like, that was my first time on stage at the Danforth and growing up in the neighborhood. And it was also this moment where I realized, like, yep, Always is in that elite club of bands that open for Fucked Up that have now eclipsed us many times over. And you've grown since then, too. So also congratulations on all the success.
Not true. Come on.
No,
Get out of here.
it's an elite club. Like, I feel like Gallows in England, Waves, Kurt Vile, yourselves. Oh, and I know there's someone I'm forgetting right now too. But there's been a few. There's been a few that, and then I feel like, I was thinking about this today. I think one of the shows that I hope goes down in Always history is the Always Fucked Up Shit Show at the Horseshoe Tavern, because I think that's going to be one of those great things in the run of shows that you have, where you're sandwiched, kind of like almost a literal fuck shit sandwich.
Actually, what? Yeah, because you had the band Shit who was
Yeah.
playing first, and then the guy came downstairs and was like, "Has anyone seen Shit?"
It's all over the walls, dude.
Because they weren't there, and he couldn't get this like the sound check going, and everything was a big disaster. But
It was a shit
yeah,
show.
exactly. Yeah, this is the middle of the day too.
Yeah. The show I most remember from that tour is the Sudbury Garage show. Do you remember that one? And there was
Absolutely.
a free range anaconda worming around in the house, which is where the washroom was. He was, do you know what the deal was with that? Was he circus adjacent or?
Have no idea. Like, it's one of those situations when and I'm sure someone has subsequently come up and told me that that house has become like much like shit too, also like somewhat legendary all these years later, because yeah, that was a weird one. It was a really fun show, but it's one of those shows that, like when you have that drive right across Canada, there's going to be something between Manitoba and Ontario, or in parts of Ontario, it's going to be a weird show that's going to stand up forever in your memory.
Yeah, deep Canadian Shield strangeness. Yeah, that fit the
Very,
bill.
very
Yeah, I remember
strange.
like sitting outside the garage in our van looking at everything, and we were like, oh, we're not going to get through all the inputs. How are we going to hear anything? This is going to be crazy. And we were so stressed out, and Sandy was like, you guys need to relax. Like,
That's what I do think that the good thing about going on tour with Fucked Up is, and I tell this to bands to this day, it's like, listen, it's not going to be glamorous, and there's probably going to be parts of it that really do suck, but you're going to come out of it a harder person than you went into
oh my God. Sage advice.
Yeah, real character builders.
I like to think that we were a small brick in the house that is Always,
Actually, you guys were the first band to take us on tour, I think.
Yep, that was our first proper tour. Thank
Yeah.
you for doing that, Dame.
Well, this, you know what? We got to move on, because this is now becoming far too about me right now. So, but I do appreciate that. I take that
Well,
on with a bit of
we can
pride.
talk about your bandmates too. I mean,
Oh,
Mike
then.
was showing up to sound check in pajama pants and stuff, and that was a revelation to us. And then he would play the show in those same PJ pants.
Yes.
It was such a cool, I don't know, you were into a world of wrestling and cannabis that was new to us, but we were happy to, sort of like soak it all in. It was a wild pan-Canadian ride.
It was a really fun tour that I look back on very fondly. And like, even then, you guys already had momentum at that point, and it was already pretty clear that, this was going to be something in terms of a band. I feel really lucky to kind of see it early on like that too. And just like the songs, every night, just like watching like win over audiences and people that were like, maybe not as into melody, and then to see them kind of like won over by these songs, it's like, yeah, this is going to be something.
Yeah, I'm sure there were a few people who were not pleased that we were the opening act.
You got a better reception than Kurt Vile did on that tour.
Oh.
Definitely some guy. Oh, it was awesome though. He rolled with it, and not that Kurt wasn't a harder person going into things than maybe myself, but I think, he came out of it a little more seasoned in terms of dealing with shitty crowds.
Grizzled.
Yeah,
Grizzled.
everyone has to learn. I feel like we spent so much time being an opening band that you learn that no one really cares about you. And sometimes they do, and that's a bonus. But you just kind of learn the ways of not caring, and then you're done once you're finished your set, and you can just do whatever you want. It's like pretty low pressure.
Yeah, it's
Abs yeah.
important to learn that game of like what touring is, and that is how little can you complain. And we learned that early. Not to say there weren't accoutrements on that run, but yeah, you guys took a chance on us, to your credit. And we were deeply grateful and still are that you did.
Well, we're probably not going to get to this tour today because we got to go way back in time now. And I got to start this off the way they really start off on this show. And I'm going to pick a number and I'm going to write it down. And normally I would show you this number, but we don't have the camera going. But like I will write down this number and promise you that I'm not going to change it. And I'm going to ask you to pick between a number of 1 and 10 to see who goes first with my next question. So I've got the number written down on my hand right now. Molly, what's your choice of number?
Three.
Okay, Alec, what's your choice of number?
Seven.
Four is the number I've written down on my hand, and I would show you, but you're going to have to trust me on this one. So, Molly, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
Oh, it's when I first picked up a fiddle in Cape Breton, and I mean, yeah, I'm slightly afraid to be on this podcast because I really don't have any punk roots or really any historical reference to, what how punk became what it is. So,
But I don't think that's not the point of this podcast. And I've heard you talk about the Primitives. I've heard you talk about Lush. I've heard you talk about Cleaners from Venus. I've heard you talk about deep cut shit on stuff. And as long as it affected you, and no matter what, in what way or what bands, like then your experience and is valid, and you're part of this punk rock tapestry.
thank you. Thanks for saying that. Yeah, I mean, the first time I heard rock music, like, I mean, the first time I heard the Ramones, and then, I just kind of got into bands like The Replacements and Shop Assistants and Dolly Mixxture, and those bands are many things. But
They're
that
punk to
was,
me, all
yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, like, there are many different ways of being punk, I guess.
them.
But yeah, and then I just got into more music that was challenging and kind of outside of my scope of what I was listening to, which is pretty much the radio until I was probably 18.
But where would you hear like those bands? Because that's like, maybe the Vaseline's because Nirvana covered them, but all those other ones are deep cut, certainly in North America.
Well, I moved to Prince Edward Island when I was probably 19, and I had all these pals that were Alex pals, and they would send me songs the same way friends just share stuff with each other. And actually, the first time I really heard the Dolly Mixxture was when I went to the old Sonic Boom location and found a compilation, Everything and More. And I pretty much that became my Bible for so long, just listening to all the different drum arrangements, and they were pop songs, but those girls were cool.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, those records are perfect. Like I don't even know where we even first heard them, because it's one of those things that like unless you found the record, and now a few years on, I think they've gotten a little bit more of a sort of a cultural kind of love to them over here, but like it was something that you had to kind of search out.
Yeah, I mean, even now, just finding any type of hard copy of what they've done is pretty competitive
Yeah.
and scarce. But my brother actually sent me a vinyl demonstration tapes, and
Like an OG?
yeah, I think so. I mean, it yeah, I think so. It's in really nice condition, but I just couldn't believe that he did that. It was like the sweetest thing, and yeah, I think that's, I mean, what else?
Because you obviously, you like where we're from. You grew up in music royalty. Was that like stifling to you in the early years? Like, and I imagine when the band starts going and when you start doing music, like I talked to Hank Williams the third one time, not for the podcast, but I met him, right? And I've always been fascinated by him and his kind of rejection of this preordained musical journey that he was supposed to go on. Maybe he would have been more commercially successful doing that, but like he didn't like it. He didn't want to do it. And the Rankin family is kind of like, that kind of level of royalty in Canada when it comes to music. Like, was this sort of you finding a different path? Like, was there pressure to kind of like go a different way? Like you mentioned picking up the fiddle.
Yeah, I mean, that was my whole life, was going to square dances and playing at Kaylee's. Same with Carrie, really. We just did that our whole childhood. But I think if I did that, it would have been the easiest path to take, which isn't appealing to me. So, and also, like, when I lost my father, and just for context, like, he passed away when I was 12, and he was my fiddle mentor. But I felt like I was just trying to retrace his steps, or maybe like play the way that he played. And it really got into my head and started overthinking everything. And it just became a lot of pressure for me. And then I became sort of like this sign of life for people who were very much missing his playing. And I thought that was a ton of pressure. And so basically I just went in a different direction. I started just writing songs when I had all this time at home alone and playing, Oasis chords on guitar. And then I just sort of kept doing that, and I would play at our school, and that felt like I was carving my own path rather than just doing something that people expected for me to do.
Do you have love for that kind of music still? Like, is that something you can go back to and listen to kind of uninhibited? Listen, I don't know if that makes sense. You like listen to that music kind of like, in the same way you'd listen to other music you enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, I hear it now, and I love it. I think it's really beautiful and pure, and really describes an era of music that I feel like is a big part of a lot of people's childhoods and even today. Like, I mean, I was in Prince Edward Island this week, and someone was just like cranking Mull River Shuffle beside me, and it was so funny. But yeah, I mean, they did really, the Rankin family really did leave a mark on a lot of people.
Yeah, they were like over in PEI, the sound of the summer when you were a kid. Like, I don't know if it was particular to the Maritimes, but that was just indelible childhood formative memories. And that got sort of wrapped up with what it meant to like be free and, on the beach or in the woods, in Carrie and Molly's case. And it kind of took like this outpost being the Maritimes and connected it to a larger thread. So you felt like you had some roots and were attached to something that wasn't just like, a piddly little island.
Yeah, like growing up, I was knew the Rankin family and recognized songs and would hear it. And it's like, I know, because it wasn't necessarily played on much music. Well, they did have videos on much music, right?
Well, I think there were different, like, I think CMT would have been probably where they would have been played, but that was the one of the things with the Rankin family, is that the genre that they operated in was such a w world that no one really knew how to market,
Yeah.
I guess you would say. So they were just sort of this anomaly, and they definitely infiltrated like a lot of different places, but also I think it was really difficult for them. I mean, they sold like CDs and tapes out of the trunks of their cars for years and years.
So yeah, was there self-releasing stuff at that point? Like it is kind of like a, like it's interesting when you think of this sort of Canadian music industry, but it's such a huge country and it's really like very few bands and mainly from like Toronto that kind of were in it at that point. Like outside of there, it seems like it was a lot more like you're saying, you're selling records out of the trunk of your car. You're like a DIY artist.
I mean, very much so. I think they really came from very little and worked extremely hard before they had support to kind of operate at the level that they eventually did. But it's pretty wild what they did without really anyone or any representation.
Yeah, they'd be, setting up their own shows, promoting that themselves. Your mom would be, as you said, selling discs and tapes out of the trunk of your car, and you know, they'd enlist like a brother to do sound and just like set up at whatever local hall. You know, it was kind of a template. You know, a lot of the punk shows in Prince Edward Island were at these Cayley halls, like these Benevolent Irish Society or whatever. So there was this sort of mutual margin sort of that supported non-commercial stuff in the Maritimes, at least.
Well, and I guess now, Alec, I want to ask you because, you know, PEI is the one place that I don't know, like, practically anything about punk from. So, how'd you get into punk, Alec?
Same way as Molly, like it would have been, you know, you're at the mercy of FM radio and much music out there growing up in the 90s or whatever. So it would have been through the gateway punk, like stuff that isn't really that at all. Like, I don't know, like Monkey Wrench by the Foo Fighters or something. You know, that's it's not, if you listen to it, it's like an outlier for them. And it was the thing that electrified me, like Downstrokes, Palm Muting, Pat Smear, you know, Machine Gun Fills, like out chords that like deviated from the diatonic, and like just that one note screaming bridge. Like it had it all for me, and everything's bone dry. It sounds amazing. So stuff like that, or Oasis or Weezer, you know, like you take your car to work, I'll take my board. Like we were into the beach punk, like the Ramones and stuff, like and going to shows, you know, pretty in high school that started. Like we didn't really know what a show was till we went, and it was very, you know, emo inflected, a lot of like Saves the Day fans in those days, and like No Use for a Name and all the sort of pop punk stuff. But it was just cool to see bands creating, and you know, that happened at the Pavilion in Halifax and the Arts Guild in Charlottetown, and you know, seeing your first floor punch was a formative moment you don't forget either.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the name of the big hardcore band from Halifax around then too. Was it like
Well, there'd be like Ripping Hammer. There was like Monine came around a lot, but they were, I think, from Ontario. Stephen McLeod from Windham Earl put on a lot of the shows. He was great. And he now writes with like B.A. Johnson, much to his credit. That great, We're All Going to Jail, But He's Gonna Die. You know that song about the Budweiser stage, Molson Amphitheater? It's about going to a Van Halen show on mushrooms. Anyway,
No, I
sidebar,
gotta
but
hear that. That sounds.
it's so good. It's on The Skid Is Hot Tonight. Anyway, yeah, he was huge in all his side bands, like Operation Impact, and out of that came like Cold Warps, Dominic Taylor, I think, was his band. But yeah, it's all very pretty obscure stuff, but kind of has a long tail.
Mean, there's also this world in the Maritimes of like Grant. Things that are pumped up by funding, and they kind of take up the majority of the conversation in space. And I think what Alec is talking about is all the stuff that was outside of that.
Yeah, it was kind of similar, simmering below, and you get a lot of that around East Coast Music Award time, the ECMAs. With the No Cases shows, which started incidentally in Sydney, Cape Breton, by a guy at the campus radio station at UCCB. And these were the shows that would happen in tandem with the official industry sanction, if you can fathom a music industry in the Maritimes. You know, it was very provincial, and modest. But, you know, Buck 65 would have been playing these things, and bands like Rock Ranger and, you know, I'm sure some Sloan side projects crept in there too. And then they eventually got appropriated by the bars in whatever town the ECMAs was in, and sort of co-opted kind of thing. But there was, yeah, always that sort of awareness that you were in a marginal geographic community and trying to find your place within that.
Well, you know, you say that, but then at the same time, to me, all the great records came out of the Maritimes, maybe a little earlier during like the sort of that literal Halifax pop explosion before the festival, obviously. But like Sloan, like Hardship Post, like Stinkin' Rich before he was Buck 65. Like there's Super Friends and Thrush Hermit. Like there's just so much Jail, like so much great stuff
Yeah.
from that period that came out of there. And yeah, it just feels like that was the most fertile kind of music area when I was a kid in Canada.
Totally. Yeah, we have a lot of love for all those guys. Like Jail, that duet on the Ashley MacIsaac record, sweet. And Molly would have been huge into that record. Obviously, Ashley used to take fiddle lessons at her house, and he was quite the punk himself. Just high kicking on with the kilt in Japan or wherever with the chieftains, and he had the leopard print like dyed hair and stuff.
Yeah, my aunt was obsessed with him, and I went to HMV one time with her and my little cousin to meet him at a signing he did because my like he was my aunt's favorite musician.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to talk about someone stepping outside of a pretty rigid idea, I think Ashley has definitely done that.
It's interesting how like because also on like with 2 hours traffic, you're on Bumstead Records, and like Katie Lang's first 7-inch came out on Bumstead Records. Like it's interesting how there's are a lot of these people from Canada that kind of are in these sort of what I would imagine as an outsider, very traditional sort of rigid genres, and like whether it's Ashley MacIsaac or Katie Lang or but just bucked against them and kind of like I imagine like that would have been that's real rebellion. Like forget being a punk, like that's you got to really build your own scene that way.
Yeah, the weirdos had to unite because there weren't enough like capital P punks around to, support a full scene, I guess, in Canada, and especially where we were from. So yeah, we in that regard, it was a little more inclusive, I guess, and you got a lot of those punk adjacent sort of people with the attitude and the the conviction to like follow their weird arrow wherever it led
But also weirdly, they are all like, not to cut you off, but they all are informed by punk. Like Katie Lang was into punk music, and like from what you're saying, Molly, too, it sounds like Ashley MacIsaac was into punk music, and there and certainly all the everyone from Sloan and Jail and Thrush Hermit, like they were all into punk and DIY and like this sort of like precursors to punk even in some cases. And so it does feel like these people taking this energy and then kind of changing the world around them, which is kind of what you wind up doing with Always.
In what way do you mean that? I mean,
Well, 'cause
I'm
like you're in a
I
very pop kind of centered world, right? And like, I listen to so many interviews before I do these podcasts, and listening to interviews with yourselves, like the stuff you're referencing and dropping and talking about music-wise is not sort of like the conventional stuff that people are referencing and talking about in this pop space. Obviously, you're a massive pop act at this point, but at the same time, like you're trying to, I don't know, like it, once again, from the outside, it appears that you're trying to kind of do it on your own terms.
Yeah, I mean, we both have an aversion to like schmoozing and any type of forced anything, really. Like I've never felt like I wanted to force our music down anyone's throat or be overtly markety. And Alec and I are both just kind of like that, but like we kind of have this meter of what we think is lame. And a lot of the time you're kind of like shooting yourself in the foot, but but I don't know. And for that reason, I'm sure we'll never really be a very big thing, but and for other reasons that are,
Yeah.
talent and whatever, just not being accessible enough and the way that
We're not, we're comfortable with at being at best like a big cult band. And we're never gonna get like substantial radio play, and we also sympathized with that, do as much as you can yourself, mindset, you know, whether that was recording or learning to mix or master, or, you know, shooting on Super 8, even though you've never held a camera before, and oh, whoops, there's a music video now. That, you know, we saw these bands the Dolly Mixture or Vaseline's, or, you know, you name it, like Shop Assistants, Motorcycle Boy, Girls at Our Best, all this stuff, and just that really spoke to us, like, to not, you don't have to like turn your nose up at anything necessarily, other than like bland music that's kind of diluting itself.
I'm so glad you brought up Girls at Our Best because no one has ever brought them up on
Oh,
the show.
really? I'm surprised at that. That's
Yeah, me
funny. I
too. I love that band so much.
Oh yeah, I don't know if they were a one and done record, but Thomas Dolby might have been the keyboardist in that band. Did you know that?
Yeah, I didn't know that actually. I think I only have, like, I've never dug that deep into them. I think I have two singles, maybe
Cool.
three, maybe three,
Yeah,
but
politics was good. That was a banger. Yeah, there's they rip. They're great.
that era of music in the UK is just so awesome to me. Like that sort of, like, the door is open. If you've got enough money to put together to put out a record, have at it, because there's distribution channels and there's just so much
Yeah.
good stuff.
And it's so neatly delineated, like January 1980, like the indie charts start in Britain. I have this book that goes from January 1980 to December 1989, and it's just a gold mine for all that stuff. You would love it. You probably have it already, but
No, I
you know,
don't. I gotta get that.
I didn't know about, like, it provides all this great context too. Like, I didn't know about the Boy Hairdressers, you know, the band that preceded Teenage Fan Club, or that Norman played with the Pastels, or, you know, all this arcane stuff that only like people like us would really care about, I guess. But you know, you'll look some of that stuff up, and it'll be just sort of earth-shatteringly beautiful things, and stuff that you would never hear elsewhere if you didn't know what you were looking for, I guess.
Oh, 100%. Like, that's what I live for that kind of, like you're saying, it's arcane knowledge and it doesn't matter. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, but that's why it's the most important shit ever, is because no one else cares about it.
Yeah, I'm glad like one dude or dudette like took the time to archive that stuff, because so much of that stuff slips away, especially from this weird like early internet generation. Like, I was going back through PEI Locals, which was the message board you would go on if you were my age, you know, and find out what shows were happening. And there was equivalent Halifax Locals, CB Locals for Cape Breton, and Moncton Locals, I think, as well. But it was a good little message board community, and you could do whatever you wanted. You could review a CD, or you could, you know, talk about shows. There was a message board. This was all like, you know, pre all contemporary bullshit. But it was a good thing, and it barely exists now, except for the Wayback Machine. Like, you get the odd snapshot here and there, like, oh yeah, that poster I made, you know, in 2006 or whatever. Yeah, that was a pretty good one. But, like, you know, bands you would have forgotten about, and little pieces of creative writing. It was like a mini zine online or something like that.
It's interesting to think about that period prior to the period we're in now, with like YouTube and streaming services and all that sort of stuff, where it's digital media and there's that sort of stuff. But I don't think people are holding on to things in the same way they were prior to, where it was just physical media. And it was sort of this idea that, like, oh, this shit's going to be around forever. And there's just so much stuff that's lost from that time period, and like stuff that was shot on like these weird arcane formats that are around for like a hot second. And then abandoned, like mini DV
Immediately.
tapes, and
Yeah.
like
Yeah, totally. It's
it.
all the pre-cloud stuff just got wiped, I
Yeah.
feel, and it sucks. Like,
Yeah, now it's around forever. Now there's no there's nothing that can be forgotten. It's all in that cloud.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting too when you think about that time period, like sort of, I look at it like when that the Desperate Bicycles put out that 7-inch, the first 7-inch in I forget what year, 70, I should know, 77. It's like six
Oh,
months after.
they're great.
So good, so good. And there's that story that like they sold like 19 copies the next day, or maybe it's like 90 copies. But anyway, they sold some number of copies the next day at Rough Trade after John Peel played it. And that was the foundation of this sort of DIY scene. And you think about like where that goes in metal and indie music and all the sort of stuff that kind of comes out of it. It's so funny that people fixate on punk being this like little band of styles and sounds and like like I was watching American Hardcore last night and people talk about like that was the only continuation of punk and it's like no, punk was like the Shop Assistants and the Dolly Mixtures and it was like a lot more interesting at times than a lot of the American hardcore stuff or the British hardcore stuff that was going on at that point.
Oh man, it radiated outward. Yeah, largely like it's insane the legacy it's had. Yeah, it's you kind of get overwhelmed trying to trace all its myriad octopus tentacles.
You get overwhelmed, but at the same time, it's like it's also one of those things where it's like, yeah, I could be focused on sports, I could be.
Which, we got into b-ball during the, the
I
run.
heard Molly, you're in like a fantasy lead with like Doug Marsh or some shit.
I was for like 2 or 3 years. I made all these friends, like they were so cute with me because I had never done it before, but I was really into watching the NBA and really into the Raptors before they had their incredible run, but it just sort of took my mind off how rotten I feel like the world was at that time or something. But yeah, I got really into it, which is kind of what I do with everything, is just become obsessive about things. So I was driving everyone around me crazy with this fantasy stuff, like just living and dying by every field goal percent.
Yeah, there was a inflection point where we were making Blue Rev recording it, and it was draft day, so everything was kicking off, and Molly was sort of lining up her statistics on the recording couch, and we had to break it to her like, "I don't think you can be involved in the league this year, Momo," and she was crushed.
I actually did weep.
You did weep.
Yeah, I cried.
That but like if you miss like here's how little I know about sports, and I know the draft's important from when I collected sports cards, but at the same time, like if you miss the draft, there's like no way you could just jump back on with what's ever left. Like, yeah, I'll make it work.
Oh, I mean, the first time I drafted so poorly that I basically did what you're describing. Like, I just what you do, I guess, is you call it like streaming, where you just like pick up a bunch of people and drop them depending on if they're on a hot streak. So that requires a lot more work than if you just have like Karl Anthony Towns, who does everything. Sorry, this is becoming
Arcane
way too
in the wrong
sports.
field, I'm afraid.
Hey, but listen, this makes sense. Now I know what people feel like when I start talking about punk, but I'm sure that for people listening right now, this is like fascinating hearing you talk about this stuff. I
Well,
like.
Molly was a quick study. She swept the league. She won the second year she was in, beat all the boys from Boise, including Doug March. So, yeah, she was good. But
That's awesome.
it sounds like your trading card thing was like maybe a precursor for all this
Oh,
seven inch
absolutely.
collecting you're doing.
Yeah, I went cards, comics, and then just music, and that's where I kind of was like, okay, this is everything I was looking for all in one place. You can be a
So
nerd.
you're a collector.
I'm a collector, yeah. It's weird because my dad's a collector. So it's like one of those nature or nurture things, I wonder. Like I look at my kids and I'm like, is this going to be a burden I'm saddling on them? Like are they going to get like, I learned it from you, Dad. That's why I got to get these Pokemon cards. But they haven't really gotten into it as much as to the unhealthy level that I'm into it.
Oh my God, I actually used to sell Pokemon cards in elementary school. And it became a thing. Like they were banned. I think basically because of me, because kids would not have their lunch money.
Well,
Because I
did
had
you?
this like gig on the side that was like dealing Pokemon cards.
If you have any of your old stash kicking around, you know those
I
things are
do.
worth like, you know they're worth like some of them are worth like millions of dollars.
Yeah, I think like some of them are like Charmander, Charmeleon, Charizard. Those ones are
Yeah.
the big money makers, which I don't think I had. I mean, like I went back and checked when all this was becoming a big thing again, and I don't think I had anything that was like worthy of money.
What you got to do is you go through, you find which ones are worth money, and then you send them off to be locked away into a, like a plastic prison and
Yeah.
graded.
It's all going down in Japan, you know? Like, I feel like they all know what's worth what. We have
Yeah.
a friend who sent like a guy, one of our close friends, a brand new package of Pokemon cards, and in it was the extremely rare, whatever, first edition Charizard or
What?
yeah, and I think that was when he was little, so now he's like checking it out, seeing what he can get.
Damn, that is one of those things where like, well, I guess it's like, you know, the equivalent of someone finding like an Amazing Fantasy 15, I think it is, with the first appearance of Spider-Man or something like that, but for like an older generation, a
That's
younger
Holy
generation,
Grail.
I should say.
Yeah, totally.
It's you got.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Because you're on a Japanese label, you've got a bunch of records on a Japanese label. Do you get to go over there often?
We've gone twice, probably our favorite place to go. And I feel as though we will be going again.
I think that would be that's my dream to get back.
You guys done it a few times, like Fuji
We did it.
Rock and stuff like that?
Yeah, we did. We Fuji Rock one time, and then we played the Hostess Weekender one time, and then we did our own show prior to that. But we never really kind of taken off in Japan, and much to my chagrin. But when I was making that wrestling TV show, I got to go there for a month, and it was the greatest month
Oh.
ever.
Where did
Yeah.
you stay?
Just in Tokyo.
Cool.
It was awesome. Like every day I went to the same ramen shop 14 days in a row.
Why not?
I was like, I'm living here. I feel like this is my new life. And like, obviously never forgot my family, but you know, at the same time, I'm like, I could just live here and
What
watch
a
wrestling.
dream.
Yeah.
Controversial.
Yeah, houses are cheap. I've been checking.
It is. It's hard, but it's hard to get citizenship, right?
I'm sure they'd make an exception for a charmer like you.
Well, don't no. I'm a family guy. I'm not doing this. This is
You
here's always trying to corrupt me with your
bring the
yeah.
fam, man.
This is that. Yeah, I
You
can bring
can
the
only
family.
choose one child.
It's like here, family. Let's we're gonna plop you into a. Yeah, I can only pick one. Oh my gosh, this is getting so dark. This podcast. Let's you know. But speaking of getting dark, you know, you brought up the wrestling thing earlier and how obsessed with it I was, and it's like that fancy basketball thing, like after a while you need something when you're in a band that's maybe not even music. Like as much as I love music, you do need something that you can almost unplug completely from this world with.
I agree. I mean, I probably do that too much, but I like to have a lot of balance because then I become fulfilled and write better music, in my opinion. But if I'm only just like chipping away at stuff all day, every day, my self-worth can really take a big dip.
Yeah, it's as you know, it's a very humbling experience, the process. Yeah, it's good to have fucking Zelda or whatever, you know, to dive into for a while.
Yeah, like, because I think that's the reason, you know, and not that people still don't find themselves in these situations, but I think that's the reason in previous generations you had so many people getting caught up in drugs and booze, obviously, is because it's, you're so bored.
Yeah, not enough subcultures, but now it's all we've got. Like it's the fragmentation. You can there's so many things to get into now. It's messed up. But it's getting a little micro for my taste, maybe. Maybe we could scale it back like half a generation's worth of subculture-y. But yeah, that's where all the fun is, just digging in to esoteria. And you know, if that's a non-musical thing, that can be super helpful for the creative brain, we find.
It's almost like though the subcultures now are bigger than the culture at this point. Like in terms of like the mass culture that exists is obviously, you know, pervasive and, you know, like Swifties and this whole thing. But then there's like all these like micro subcultures that are like unbelievably huge. And, you know, like I'll never forget the first time we played with Ghostmane like maybe 10 years ago and realizing like, oh my God, I know nothing about music now. And like my eldest is into these rappers that are YouTubers that have huge followings that I once most people you ask they're like I have never heard of that in my life and it's like wow this person is massively popular.
Yeah, I do feel like it's really easy to fall behind now because there's so much stuff on like exclusive platforms and apps that have their own humongous following. So if you don't have that, you really don't see what's big or what's popular. I don't know if that makes sense, but like I don't really have any of the big apps like Instagram or TikTok or any of that or Facebook, but like I feel like all information now and trends are on those. And I don't really know how I find out about anything anymore.
Yeah, it's still just through our friends and wish it would happen more often, you know, and going down wormholes. But yeah, there is algorithmic fragmentation going on, so there's like barely any unified thing to be, you know, opposed to almost, except maybe that, you know, monolithic sort of presence of these, you know, social media companies that fragment our lives and suck up so much of our energy, I suppose. Yeah, it's there's so much, like you said, like you know, the SoundCloud rap scene, like there's just how would you ever like crack that nut as like a one of us, you know, you'd have to like pour all your time into it.
Yeah, like could you imagine if like a cultural weekly magazine came back now? It'd have to be like the size of a phone book just to cover all the culture that happens now. Because, like you said, Molly, there's like Twitch stars and there's TikTok stars and there's Instagram stars. And like these people all have millions and millions of people supporting them and they're able to live off, I don't know, their content, I guess, for or maybe their art, you know, like whatever they're doing. And yet, if you don't have Twitch, you'd have no idea who this person is.
Yeah, I mean, I don't I've I will refrain from saying it's good or bad. I mean, it's cool that pretty much anyone can make music now. But I don't know. I do feel really out of the loop. Like even you were just talking about weekly magazines and papers and stuff, like I feel like that's how I used to find out who was playing where and even just like you don't really buy tickets at record stores anymore. I didn't know that was a thing. I'm now exposing my age, but everything is just like
Well, there's not even any websites anymore. You know, like no one goes to like a message board or whatever we used to do. You know, there's no even digital unifier anymore. Like we used to have, you know, for example, like reruns on TV. And then that would provide a common cultural lexicon for everyone. And you could talk, reference something, and sure enough, you know, 9 times out of 10, the person would know what you were talking about and you had some common ground. But now, like, that's an unintended side effect of, you know, yet another American website or app just like arson things up, namely Netflix, you know, no one's like bemoaning the loss of reruns, I guess, except me. But, you know, there's just all these trickle down effects that we don't really reckon with until we're put in that scenario.
Oh, I would kill. Like, that's the thing with, there are reruns still, but it's only like Seinfeld or The Simpsons, or like, there's only like 5 shows. Like, I'd love to see a Night Court rerun. Or it was Michael Imperioli was just on the podcast and we talked about, Basketball Diaries, and he's like, oh, it's such a, he's like, yeah, it's not a great film, and like, you know, kind of bemoaning this thing. And it's like, yeah, it's got its faults, but like, you think about the cultural impact of even movies that people didn't like back then. Like,
yeah
everyone, you had saw that movie,
totally. And there was a cycle of, you know, maybe 16 or so on TBS or whatever.
Oh my god, you'd be like, Jaws is on again.
Yeah, let's do this.
Yes.
Independence Day, baby.
Yeah, I'm gonna sit here. But those still are the only things, like, from, well, maybe it's changed, but when I was at Much Music, you look at the ratings and you're like, God, how is this like movie from like 1993 beating our ass every time in the ratings? Because it's just like people are just like,
so sad.
Toning in.
Man, because Much was so huge and effective as a unifier in pop culture. Like, it was one of the few strands we had, you know, growing up in a remote location. Like, Going Coastal was massive, The Wedge obviously, and you know, just George Strombo's show. Like, you know, there, you couldn't really, it's tough to overstate what a loss that was when it just went Much Music the way of the odd Simpsons rerun and reality shows. It was just like, you're kidding, like, you're going this because these numbers say that, like, really sucks. But we're still listening to Zoomer Radio, another Chum City property here in Toronto.
Is it, or that, no, that's Moses on his own, I think, right?
Oh, did he branch out? I don't,
oh yeah,
know
he got, when he left Much Music,
I
think he started Zoomer Media then.
Oh, maybe that's why it's good.
You know? Yeah, he was a real interesting person. Like, obviously, you know, a lot of opinions, a lot of about him, from people that worked with him and worked for him. But I only met him a couple times. But he just kind of, you look at what we had access to as people who had Canadian cable or Canadian, you know, terrestrial access to it, signal wise, you know, like movie television, like music television, the new music, like, just so all this stuff that's like precursors to the early days of the internet with websites, like, you know, Speaker's Corner, like, that's YouTube.
Yeah, that was way ahead of its time and so cool. And, you know, hilarious. There was a democratic element there. And there was with, what was the dance show?
Electric Circus.
Electric Circus, yeah. Like, you could line up outside, you'd like strut your stuff, like, bust a few moves, and you'd be in or out. You know, either you'd be along the curb, in the window, you know, dancing on the outside, or if you had good enough moves, they'd bring you in with the ringers, and yeah, you'd be bumping and grinding with the best of them. Yeah, really, really miss that. I drive Molly nuts with how obsessed I am with some of that passing stuff, like Snow Job, the one in Newfoundland at Marble Mountain in particular, that Sloan played on the side of the hill. And it's super punk, like Andrew Scott, the drummer's all wrapped up in a scarf and they're all freezing their butts off. And
yeah,
and then Chris Murphy goes skiing afterwards with Mike Campbell and is cracking jokes the whole time. And he's a great skier. He's making fun of the locals, like, oh, do a 360 or call, you know, saying he gave lessons to the dude doing jumps and stuff. And then Wilco also played this same show and crushed it. They brought like their Leslie speaker on the snow hill they loved the show so much they pressed it to vinyl, I believe. And right before the guitar solo, Bob Egan, who's now in Blue Rodeo, gets so amped up that he starts jumping and he falls on his back into the snow and keeps the solo going, like just ripping. It's the funniest thing ever. And yeah, it's uniquely Canadian, and maybe a bunch of people won't give a hoot, but I certainly
that's awesome. I loved it. I loved that kind of content. And I think in another dimension, Chris Murphy is our Jimmy Fallon, but actually funny up here, because he is like, he's one of the funniest dudes in the world.
He's got it.
He's got
whatever it is.
Yeah, like from day one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember like that. Oh, sorry. I was going to say that. Do you remember when they were playing one of those Much Music concerts and he just like ran outside the building, was like yelling the chord changes to them, like the rest of his band, like, as if they didn't know.
Yeah, one of the intermittent interactives.
Yeah. Yeah. So funny.
Yeah. Total ham.
Total ham. And like, and just talk about someone that almost feels like purpose built for this, you know, like he's straight edge. He's naturally got that like need to ham it up in every situation. And he looks kind of like David Koresh. Like he's got that weird kind of handsomeness.
So you have a crush on him is what you're saying.
I've had a crush on him. I've told him this to his face for years, you know, he's an incredible, like, you know, and I was like, I love Sloan, but I was never the biggest Sloan fan, but I've always been a massive Chris Murphy fan.
Yeah, we were too. I mean, like that was one of the first videos I remember on Much, like having like a, oh my God, what the hell is this effect? Everything You've Done Wrong, a wedding video was just like.
Yeah, I feel like we talk about Sloan in every interview, but it really can't be overstated, their impact on Canadian music.
Yeah, they paved the way, and I guess started. Did they start Murder Records?
Yep.
Which, to their credit, I mean, put out a bunch of cool Al Tuck records. Maybe you have some. I certainly don't. But
not a complete Murder Records catalog, but I lucked out and found a guy at the flea market, the old antique market down at St. Lawrence one day, who just had a box of every cool Maritimes indie punk record, like back to the 70s.
Oh man, do you have that Nevermind the Mollusks?
Yes. Yeah, I got that. I got the Null and Void. I got Wild. I'm trying to remember some of these bands, I think that's where I got, do you know the Dry Heaves from, I think they were from New Brunswick, maybe?
No, but that's an incredible name.
They are, there's also, because there's another Dry Heaves from, I believe, London or Windsor. And, but this is like, Windsor, sorry. And the, but this is like the Maritime Dry Heaves. That is awesome. Just like really art damaged, like heavy. But yeah, they're fantastic. There's so much cool stuff there. And it's like a cool tradition. But like you're saying, Sloan, like growing up, there was like a lot of bands that I liked, a lot of music, but not a lot of stuff that you could be like, oh, that's cool. Like Bryan Adams, great songs, loved them, but not necessarily cool. And Celine Dion wasn't necessarily cool, but Sloan was cool.
Yeah, and they were deep too, you know. You could dig into any one of their records, like One Chord to Another was probably the first one that we would have intercepted, and then from there you go on to Navy Blues and the Twice Removed, and you know, it wasn't until much later that I learned about Smeared, and in particular like I Am the Cancer, that Chris song, which is just a smoking piece of My Bloody Valentine aping that I love so much, and I ape that song quite a bit. But you know, the Eric's Trip thing, they were kind of maybe a little more no wave, that Sackville would have been like probably the closest stuff to where I came up, and there was something percolating there. It was always cool when you'd go over to Sackville because it was college town, and you played George's Roadhouse. I remember seeing the Constantines there, and people lit off fireworks in the street, like it was at the end of a road right by a via rail train station that didn't get much action, and it was one of the best shows I've ever seen. It was, we played a show there, a few shows there too. We played like Sappy Fest early on. We had to make our own self-released tape as a precondition of playing Sappy Fest. Like, they were like, you can play here, but you gotta have something to sell. So we just like cheekily put a little cassette together, and that was our first self-titled, our first record. So probably weren't supposed to do that, but whatever. But crazy shows there. Like, there's one show at the Legion in Sackville that, like, we would hang our always flag behind the drum kit, and it got torn off the wall pretty quickly, and Molly had to do a little tug of war for it.
So did you, when you did, is the self-release tape what you sent to Polyvinyl? Like, how did that connection happen?
I think we just had a Bandcamp or a SoundCloud. I think we had a SoundCloud, and Polyvinyl just listened to two of the songs, and that was it for them, I guess. We couldn't really get anyone in Canada to release the album. Like, we really couldn't get anyone to release the album. So our manager at the time just was starting a label, and he was like, well, I'll release it on this label. But it was brand new. We were like one of the first albums to come out on that Canadian label, Royal Mountain.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So that, so that was that for Royal Mountain before it was Polyvinyl type thing?
Polyvinyl was the first label that was interested, I think, with us, or in us, and then everything, like in the UK, there was interest there too, but not in Canada.
Yeah, we kind of broke in the UK first.
You have to do it. That's the only way to do it.
Yeah, they like songs over there.
Yeah,
so you got to do it. I'm sure it was similar for you guys.
Absolutely. No, like, we couldn't get, I'm pretty sure we were reviewed in NME before we were reviewed in Exclaim.
Yeah, I mean, and at the time you probably think it's like a frustrating thing, but it actually ends up being a good thing.
Yeah.
Just because you don't become like this Canadian band that can't play a show in outside of Canada. But I don't know if that's a thing for you guys or.
Oh, it's, well, we have even something more here. Like, I'm sure you're familiar with it being here now, but like, there's almost like the, and it's probably less so now actually because we don't have the weeklies, but there's the Toronto band where you would become huge. You'd get on the cover of Now or I, and you would be like the band in Toronto. Like, you know, you'd headline horseshoe shows and sell them out and all this sort of thing. But that would be it. You know, like, you'd get almost like kind of trapped in the city, and none of these bands would tour. There's so many great bands that just never really made it out of Toronto that were huge here.
I mean, I'm sure that exists in every town and region, but I mean, there was a huge thing in the Maritimes that was like that. It's like, you could be the biggest band in town and everyone would know who you are and come to all the shows, but no one would have any idea who you were in Toronto. And that wasn't the case for us. We were big or whatever when we left, but it is like a really its own little cave.
Yeah, we'd been through it a couple times with like high school bands or whatever. And I had this band, the Danks, that, you know, played a lot in the Maritimes, and we were kind of like Strokes, Inflected, or the Hives or something, or Devo. Had got used to that experience of like overplaying the Maritimes. And then as soon as you get out, you're like, you know, starting from square one. So with Always, you know, some of our first shows were like in Columbus, Ohio, or New York, or Toronto, just trying to like start in population centers. Yeah. You know, where there was sufficient, you know, subculture density to warrant us playing. And like, to this day, we're still a fairly urban band. What did you say, Molly? Like, it's tough for us to like play Sydney, Cape Breton or something.
Oh, we could. I mean, like, we can't really go to Moncton and play to a full room of people.
But, really? At this point?
I
a full small room, sure.
Yeah. But we don't sell beer. Like, we're just this weird band that, like, our music isn't weird, I don't think, but we just have this, occupy this strange space of being big in certain places, and then in, I guess, like, yeah, like, no one would, like, hoist a beer and, like, be like, yarr.
Yeah.
Which is the barometer where we're from, the pirate noise.
Yeah, you gotta, because it, there's those bands, there's the bands that the sound guy likes, and I've never been in one of those bands. Like, I've never been in a beer band, and I've never been in a sound guy liking band. I've been just in bands that...
Well, generally, you have to do sound checks in order to be a sound guy band. You guys seem averse to those, so...
Yeah, I'm better at doing that now. I definitely am. I've gotten over myself and my thing of not wanting to blow out my voice by doing one song during sound check. But
oh, I didn't realize that's what was going on.
Yeah,
I didn't realize, like, were other people sound checking though? Because I feel like it wasn't only you.
That might have been no. Yeah, like, I think everyone else would normally sound check by that point. It's
okay. Not on this Canadian tour we did. Not to correct the record, but
please.
There wasn't much of any
sound checking,
mic testing, vocal or otherwise.
No, they don't test the mic at that point. Like, when we go to England, we'll have like our buddy Tom over there, and he'll test the mic for me and do stuff for me, so I don't have to sound check. But like, I realize now, if I don't sound check, it's not like someone from Fucked Up's going up just to yell in the mic and try it out. Like, it's just left raw. Sometimes my monitors aren't even turned on. Sometimes
we thought that was so cool though, like, that you guys, you know, were that confident that you could just be like, yeah, fuck it, we'll play the show, it'll be great.
I think it's because we, you know, we sounded shit for so long, and you'd show up at a show and be like, oh, there's no PA and I'm going to be yelling through a bass amp. Okay, fine, fuck it.
Oh no. You know, yeah,
like, DIY spaces are awesome because they allow anyone to get up there and do their thing. Like, surviving, obviously excluding assholes who are terrible people, but like, theoretically, people, anyone can get up there and do their thing, but the sound might not be that great. the gear that you're going to be doing it with might not be up to
code.
Professional coded standards.
Yeah, I think it's like one of those important things to start at the bottom, so when things go wrong, you're not completely destroyed by it. Like, I feel like we still play festivals where really fundamental things will go wrong, because that's just how it works, and it's not foreign to me because we did so much of that years ago, where you just like would play without any monitors, or with people just like screaming in your face. People would come on stage and tell you to keep playing, like, just really wild things that you just become accustomed to.
Yeah, because then you see performers that you know, they just fall apart on stage when something starts going wrong, and it's like, no one, I tell this to people all the time, like, no one notices in the crowd if something goes wrong, as long as you don't sell it, you know. Like, obviously if all the mics go off and you can't sing, but like, if you just went into a solo at that part, no one's gonna miss a beat.
And more importantly, no one cares what you're going through on stage.
Yes.
Like, it's like not their concern if the monitors aren't working, or you have the wrong levels, or the, you know, the Tom mic falls off. It's like,
sorry, go on. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I was just gonna say, you probably don't even need a Tom mic. Yeah, so don't worry about it.
No. That's my thing. I also feel like I want to see, not that I want anyone to have a terrible performance where they're going through strife on stage, but at the same time, I want to see something that I can't replicate by just going on YouTube and watching this band do a perfect performance somewhere. I want to see a memorable experience that night. And if that's a show that winds up being kind of a disaster, that's awesome. Like, I got to see that.
Yeah.
I'm happy with that experience. It was a real experience.
I want to see them break a string. I'm in the same boat identically. Like, and it's not like a Schadenfreude, like, malevolent impulse or anything, but it's just so real, and it you can't replicate it, like you said.
Yeah. Yeah. Did your approach to always change, like, same way with Molly based on her previous musical experience, but like with doing 2 hours traffic and kind of being more in like a, I imagine it would be more kind of like a Canadian musical experience type thing.
That was Yeah, I wouldn't know what the typical thing was. We certainly went like coast to coast Canada a few times in that band, and felt those sort of limits when we tried to go elsewhere.
Yeah.
We were very young. Like it was my I started the band in high school with Liam, and just you know didn't have our adult brains yet. They're still playing and stuff, but yeah, I think I took from that like, you know, you do have to play elsewhere, and also that you're not as weird as you think you are musically. Like, I thought we were like playing like, you know, pretty somewhat left to center pop music or whatever, but you know, to everyone else, it's just sort of like pretty like down the middle kind of thing. So maybe one of the lessons I took with that into Always was to try to skew stranger than you are comfortable with doing, and odds are people won't register it as such. It might not get radio play, but it actually comes out a little more singular. I don't know, Molly, if you strive for strangeness too, like maybe that's what you did initially when you wanted to record with Chad. Like you were seeking that kind of gritty, you know, Calgary thing, like the punk, like that Women, that Public Strain record, you know, sound you might have been going for or something.
Yeah, I think my brother sent me Soft Airplanes, the Chad Van Galen album, and because he had just moved to Calgary, so he sent me a few Calgary artists in the mail, a few CDs, and I thought it would be really cool to see what his production would sound like on some of the songs that we were writing. But I didn't think he would ever agree to record us, so that was a surprise, and then ended up making our first album with him. But I just felt like there was no point in having any rules or listening to any industry people about anything because I really felt like no one understood what was happening with music. And I still kind of feel like that. Like you just have to sort of make it work and do it however you know how to do it, and s just see it through because I don't think there's a really a formula anymore.
Yeah, no, there's so many, well, like you're saying earlier, there's so many paths to it, right? There's so many different ways, and there's so many different metrics of success now too. It's not good review from this magazine anymore, because those don't necessarily mean anything. Like it's not necessarily views on this platform, because those don't necessarily mean anything. Like it's, I don't know, it just feels like there's so many more ways of defining success now too.
Yeah, and you have to look inward for that as well, like being truly satisfied with what you've produced. Like you know, Molly and I had recorded some stuff together, and like you know, we would be rushed by totally arbitrary things like, oh, we got a show at Hunter's Ale House, you know, in 3 weeks, so we better, you know, finish this mix up. And we, when we could have spent like more time just getting it right and not deluding ourselves. So we made a point on from always, like from the inception, to never pull the wool over our own eyes, I guess. If something wasn't like speaking to our like hardened reptile hearts, then, you know, how could we expect it to move somebody else, you know, to give someone the chills or whatever. So we, you know, when faced with problems, we would like then pick up the requisite skills to amend those problems and solve them, or like find a way to smear something so the problem is obfuscated, you know, like just it's, and it's fun to do that, to like get the means of production at your fingertips and just like take it over, and like people, you know, on your way up will tell you how to do things so often, and a lot of it's just BS.
Yeah, like, and totally, like, and now if someone tells you, you know, and what you're doing is not going to work, it's like, well, I'll just find a new way to do it. Or there's got to be a way around you now. Like, there's no,
You know, like from
or you just say, no, it works.
Yeah, it works. Like, I'm just going to put it out anyway. What are you going to do to stop me?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Well, this has been awesome. And even though it took us a long time to do it, anytime either of you or both of you want to come back on and talk about music or TikTok, I think I'm the only one who talks about TikTok, but you're both welcome.
Yeah. Should we cover punk at all in this?
Well, I don't know. I think we kind of did, right? Like, is your, well, I don't know. Like, I think Sloan is punk. Chris is a punk. Like, that's my definition of it, is that if you were affected by it or listened to it or claimed it at any point in your life, and then we can cut this out if you don't want to talk about it, but did you have like some crazy shit involving punk and police at some point, Molly?
Oh yeah. I was arrested for assaulting a police officer. yeah, that did happen. I had like really no fear when I was that age. I was like maybe 20, which is really naive, but it actually did really change my perspective on police and how much they lie.
Yeah.
Because everything that happened was so different than what they had written up on their accounts, which it was sent to me in the mail months and months later, but I just like was reading, you know, what they said had happened, and I just couldn't believe it. So yeah, it really changed my perspective on cops and stuff. But yeah, they were just like choking a friend of mine, and I jumped on top of them. At one point, like, I just like feared for their life, so I jumped on top of one of them and just basically hit him as many times as I could.
That's punk. That's pretty punk.
And yeah, well, I mean, I'm not proud of my behavior, but it was like a really embarrassing thing to go through, and I'm lucky that I didn't, you know.
Well, I'm proud of your behavior, because that friend was me.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's I had no idea. I remember you telling me that story, but I think Alec, I don't know if I knew Alec was the person in question.
Yeah, it was Alec. But anyway, that, you know, that's behind us, but I would probably do it again. I won't do it again, but if I could go back, I would have done the same thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, if it comes down to saving Alec, you're going to save Alec.
Yeah, they're, I mean, city cops are pretty unhinged.
Yeah, there's definitely, like, that's a running thing. It's funny, I interviewed this guy, from Indonesia the other day, who plays in this incredible, arguably one of the biggest hardcore bands in the world, but just because of it, they're just super popular in and around Indonesia, called Seringe. And he was telling me that they have to deal with all this cop shit all the time. And then, I was interviewing, some California punk dudes the other day, and they're talking about how they had to deal with cops all the time back in the day. And it's like, wow, that's a universal experience.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really even know. There's so much that needs to change, obviously, but I don't even know the beginning of it, just, you know, because I'm, you know, not, I'm just like a white girl, basically. But so I really can't speak to any type of, you know, oppression in any way.
Yeah,
but no, I can imagine what someone that doesn't look like me would have encountered if they did what I did.
Yeah, that's definitely worth noting as well. And like you said, there's a lot that has to change.
Yeah, sorry, we ended this on a really sober note. Not really. Feel free to edit this.
Well, you're the one who said, let's talk about punk shit. And I'm like, oh, wait, I got a punk thing we can talk about. But
how about ACAB?
Yeah. The real podcast starts now.
Yeah, now this thing becomes one of those Dirtbag Left podcasts. Immediately slips right into it.
Yeah, totally.
Chapo, here we come. Yeah. This was great. I you know, we loved talking to you. Absolutely. And you know, we probably should have shouted out like Dog Day or like, you know, bands like that, I guess, a little more, but whatever. No mulligans, you know.
Well, that's for part two.
Oh yeah, P2, save it for the sequel.
You know, there's got to be something left for the sequel.
That's awesome.
Yeah, thanks, Damien. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Alec and Molly, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, they will be back for a part two at some point in the future. So check out Blue Rev and check them out on tour if you are in one of those places that they are coming to. And then check them out in the new year when they come on tour. Very sweet, sweet people. And awesome to see what they've done, as I said many times in that episode. All right, on to the next one on the next episode of Turned Out of Punk. From the Eric Andre Show, from the movie Bad Trip, and from the brand new book, Dumb Ideas, Dan Curry and Eric Andre will be on the show. And it is a fun conversation that goes, it goes nowhere at first and then goes deep. It goes deep by the end, but that it's got a little bit of a bumpy takeoff. But you'll hear it on the next episode. And that is it for me. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues faced by Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights. Stop hate and violence towards people of different races or different faiths. Because we're not talking about... This isn't political. This is just human rights stuff. People deserve to be able to live free from hate, violence, discrimination, and violence. So if there's organizations that are making positive change in your world around you, get involved. Donate your time, donate your money. I'd also add to that, like, what you want to do with your reproductive system is a basic freedom issue too. So if there's organizations that are affecting change, get involved with them. Speaking about getting involved, get involved in punk. Anyone can do this stuff. Start a band, start a fanzine, start doing flyers, start anything. You know, build the community that you want to see. It gets better when you get involved. Speaking about things that get better when you get involved, donate your organs, because without you donating them, there's no organs to be donated. And I've seen it perform miracles. I've seen it with my own eyes. And it's incredible to see it happen. Well, I wasn't in the room when it actually happened. But, like, I saw the miracle that kind of came afterwards. Anyway, sign your organ donor cards. And try meditating. A lot of people know about it. A lot of people have done it for thousands of years. I came to it a little bit later. But it changed my life, and maybe it'll change yours, too. You don't have to subscribe to anything or any ideology or any of that stuff. Just... there's lots of different types of practice, and try one and find one that works for you. And that is it for me. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode.